can keep them all locked except the one I want to use. Go ahead and pile them on in a jumble." He gave her Paris, New York, Dubai, Singapore, Kathmandu, Accra, Brisbane, Sao Paulo, a dozen other cities, not to mention the Greek family's office building in Athens, the North family compound in Virginia, and the Library of Congress. "It's practically the whole atlas," said Vivi admiringly. "I'll add as many gates as you want," said Danny. "No, I'm not jealous. And I know you'll open a gate to anywhere I want. What I'm worried about, Danny, is that there's no gate that takes me to you." Hermia nodded. We have all these gate mouths with us. But we need a gate whose tail always leads to wherever you are." "I can't have you popping out of my pocket," said Danny. "I know," said Vivi. "Have us come out of an old-fashioned oil lamp. We can be your genies." "Amusing as that sounds," said Danny, "I don't want you popping up when I'm on the John."
"What if you need our help?" asked Hermia.
"I'll always know where these gates are. If I need to, I can move the tail of one of your portable gates to a place near me."
"Unless you're unconscious," said Vivi.
"I'll think about this," said Danny. "You can lock it," said Hermia, "and then unlock it if you need us. We aren't going to intrude on your privacy."
"We unlock it ourselves only if we think something is really wrong," said Vivi.
"We peek through ahead of time," said Hermia. Danny hated the whole idea. It was one thing to give them the power to go anywhere by using their amulets, but to give someone constant access to him, that wasn't going to happen, even if they promised not to use it.
"I don't think he sees a difference between peeking through a gate and coming through it," said Vivi. "He doesn't want to be spied on."
"You have to trust us," said Hermia. "I said I'd think about it," said Danny.
"Meaning the answer is no," said Vivi.
"It's really unfair," said Hermia. "You can make a gate any time you want, no matter what we're doing. We can't hide from you, but you don't think we can be trusted not to spy on you or intrude when you're kissing some girl."
"We won't take pictures," said Vivi. "Or at least we won't post them online."
"I said," Danny began.
"He's getting testy now," said Vivi.
"I don't spy on you," said Danny. "And I know you won't spy on me. But that's how power is. Just because you have a power doesn't mean you want other people to use their power on you. Fairness only seems reasonable when the other person is more powerful than you."
"As it seems to us," said Hermia.
"I hate to sound like one of the family," said Danny, "but you're just going to have to live with it till I get used to the idea. Maybe someday I'll wish I had made gates that follow me around like puppies so you can always find me. But right now I don't know how to do that, and I don't think I even want to, and so I won't."
"Tough guy," said Vivi.
"He's not so tough," said Hermia. "He sounds like he's apologizing. Real assholes don't even pretend to be sorry."
"True," said Vivi.
"It isn't in his nature, so he's not good at assholery yet." "Thanks," said Danny, "I think."
"Well," said Hermia, "I'd better go, or the family will track me here."
"You've got to get those trackers out of her," said Vivi.
She was right. Danny studied Hermia, then passed a gate over her, one that left her exactly where she was.
"What was that about?" asked Hermia.
"I didn't know what I might have gained by going to Westall," said Danny. "For all I know, I might always have had the ability to attach gates to portable objects, and maybe going through a great gate doesn't affect the mage who made it. But I think there is a difference. When you went through the gate I just made, I could feel a difference in you. The places where the gate was trying to heal you and meeting with resistance. Maybe that's what it was, anyway. I counted 5 places like that."
"You should just send her through an airport scanner," said Vivi. "They'll show you exactly where the trackers are implanted."
Danny laughed.
"Of course. Vivi, will you come along and make a distraction?"
He took them to the Roanoke airport. Vivi got to the end of the security line and then started wailing.
"Where's my ticket? I had my ticket right here."
Her noise drew everyone's attention. And in the moment, Danny put Hermia right in front of the security gate, ahead of the person at the front of the line. Then he opened a peephole over the shoulder of the TSA official working the screen. Vivi, seeing Hermia in place, took off on an elaborate charade of searching for her lost boarding pass. The guard waved Hermia into the machine. Danny had been right about the trackers. 5 of them. Exactly where he had felt the gate trying and failing to heal her. The trip to Westall had given him more power, a sharper focus, a greater awareness. He moved the porthole to a spot an inch from Hermia's ear. "Gate to my house in Buena Vista," he said. Then he gave the same message to Vivi. In a moment, they were all there. "I spotted 5 trackers," said Danny. "I think I can gate them out." "Think," said Hermia, "this is my body we're talking about. I'll have a nice big gate ready for you to pass through, so when I get each one out, you can heal yourself instantly. What can go wrong?" "Famous last words," said Vivi. But after another minute of dithering, Hermia said, "Oh, just do it."
"Are you sure?" said Danny.
"Do it, gate boy," said Vivi. "Can't you tell when a woman's saying yes? You really are young." In about 10 seconds, Danny was done. There were 5 chips on the table, and Danny had passed the healing gate over Hermia after removing each one. It was very quick.
"It did hurt," said Hermia. "Surgery is surgery."
"Sorry," said Danny.
"I was just reporting, so you'd know," said Hermia. "I never thought it would be painless, so it wasn't a complaint." She picked up one of the chips. "So my parents thought it would be a good idea to put these things in their baby girl."
"The question is, what do we do with them?" said Vivi. "I say gate them to an incinerator."
"Or implant them in somebody else," said Hermia.
"That wouldn't be nice," said Vivi.
"I was thinking, what about the president, or Prince Charles," said Hermia, "or some dictator somewhere. Make my family go chasing them."
"Or 5 different people," said Vivi. "Make them go crazy trying to figure out which one is you."
In the end, Danny gated 1 tracker under the skin of each of the Hittite Armenian assassins and sent the other trackers about a mile deep in the Atlantic. Then he gated the 2 assassins from the jail to the Greek family's offices in Athens.
"Let my folks deal with them," said Hermia.
"Are you going to tell them what the bastards tried to do to you?" asked Vivi.
"No," said Hermia. "Let them try to talk to each other. They'll know we picked these clowns to receive exactly 2 of the trackers for a reason. They'll know it wasn't random. But if I tell my family, they'll just kill them. Even if they are seriously angry at me, they won't approve of assassins from another family going after me."
"So you think the assassins won't talk?" asked Danny.
"My family won't dangle them upside down over the ocean," said Hermia.
"Or maybe they will, but they won't do it as cleverly and magically as you did."
"We are gate mages, aren't we?" said Vivi with some satisfaction. "It's so much fun to prank everybody at once."
They went to Vivi's favorite gelato place, Angelato, on Arizona Avenue in Santa Monica, and ate their gelatos on the 3rd Street promenade. Then all 3 of them gated away to wherever they were going to spend the night. Vivi laughed in delight as she prepared to stick a finger into one of her rings.
"Oh, I feel so powerful, like the first time I got the keys to the family car."
Then she was gone.
Alone in his little house in Buena Vista, Danny could hardly believe what he had done in a single day. Went to Westall and met the gate thief, created portable gates for his friends, removed the tracking chips from Hermia, ate dessert in California, and got back before bedtime. Botched a great gate. He really wanted to think about Xena as he went to sleep, but all he could think about was the angry gate that Marion and Leslie were tending now. How could he do something that stupid? And then, inexplicably, he thought of Coach Leader's daughter, Nikki. How was she doing? Had they realized yet that she was healed of her cancer? That, at least, was something Danny hadn't screwed up.
Chapter 8. Search. It should have been easy for Wad to find the Wind Mage from Middlegard, whom Danny North had called Sed. Not only was there a swath of destruction across a long stretch of Hedderby, making it easy to narrow down his location, but even if he tried to blend into the local population, even if he had acquired local clothing, His foreignness had to be obvious from his language. Heatherwee was a broad plain that got heavy snow in winter, but scant rain in summer. The grass was fast growing, and the sod was thick. But the whole world turned brown by midsummer, and the grazing herds now stayed close to the many streams that flowed down from the Mithercame, the high mountains. Mithercame was high and thickly forested, a place where mages of stone and water, tree and eagle, prospered and grew strong. Wind could whistle and whine through canyons and narrow passes. But Heatherwee was a wide-open land where the wind made waves in the high grass, rippling for miles. There, the wind could dance. Deep in the grass, insects abounded, eating fallen seeds. Birds and rodents came to eat the seeds as well, and to eat the insects, too. And great grazing animals came in vast herds to slice or tear off the grass well above the matted sod. The predators, wolves and great cats, came to cull the lame and old and unprotected young from the herds. Here a mage of herding beasts and a mage of predators could equally find a home. It was a place where a traveler could walk for days without any certainty that he had come any closer to his destination or escaped any distance from the place where he began. Yet somehow in this dry, grassy wilderness, small villages of drowthers found a way to make their homes of cut-up sod, scratch their tiny farms out of the clay that they exposed, and one way or another eke out a living and store up enough strength to spawn a next generation, and then another. They did not hunt the herding beasts, for fear that they were watched over by a beast mage. Nor did they wander alone, for fear that a mage-ridden predator would hunt them down for sport. They kept to themselves. They watched the weather on which their precarious lives depended. Wariness kept them alive. Wad gated from village to village, coming in as a stranger, but one who knew the language, for Wad could speak all the variants of Westall spoken in this world, or at least he never found one he couldn't pick up in a few minutes. He dressed himself in clothing that made him seem to be a journeyman in search of work. He should have been far more acceptable than said in these little villages, yet Wad could see that they were lying to protect the Windmage from Middlegard. My friend would have come soon before or soon after the storm that stripped your fields and blew down your houses, Wad said in village after village. I have to find him. His wife is ill, and I must get him home for the children's sake. But they never answered him except with a shrug, or, if he forced the issue, a defiant stance, brandishing a stout stick and daring him to ask another question. Somehow, though gales had torn roofs from houses and hail had ravaged the already scanty fields, these people took Sed as one of them, instead of seeing that he was the one who had caused their misery. Despite the help of the drowthers, Sed could not hide from a gatefather forever. If the people would not talk to Wad openly, he would open a tiny window in their houses and listen to their conversation. They told him all he wanted to know, and more. They knew that Sed was the Windmage who had harmed them so. They knew he came from another world. Sed had told them all of this himself. He was the god of the wind, come in person to apologize for the harm his mighty gales had wrought, and to make amends as best he could. At last a window revealed Sed himself, asleep in the place of honor near the fire, in a house with a chimney, marking it as the richest in the hamlet. Wad gated him from the house so gently that he didn't wake up. It was the cold that woke him, half an hour later. The wind itself, cold and thin at the top of a high crag in the Mithercame. Sed awoke shivering, and knew at once that a gate mage had him. For how else could he have been taken out of the warm house and out into the cold? The wind told him he was in an open place, the lightness of the air, that he was very high up. And when he opened his eyes, the starlight showed him that he lay on a patch of ground not more than 10 strides in every direction before a drop-off that hid the rest of the world from view. "Sorry to take you from the fire," said the young man who sat watching him. Sed recognized him at once. The mage who had come to meet Danny North at the tail of the great gate. The gate thief. The enemy.
I'm not the one you want, Sed warned the man at once. He went back to Earth.
I know where Danny North is, said the gate thief. He has most of my outself with him. Is the captive ever unaware of the boundaries of his prison?
Is that where I am now?
A prison? Asked Sed. A place for undistracted conversation, said the gate thief. No one will interrupt us. But a mage of your power, no, I could not keep you here if you wanted to be gone.
A mage of my power, Sed answered scornfully. A monster power that harms everyone and helps no one.
And yet you keep using it, said the gate thief.
The air calls to me, Sed whispered. Day and night I hear it singing. I feel it on the hairs of my arms, my legs. It wakens me and I can feel the motion of all the airs of the world. Far away winds and gales, nearby breezes, the passing of a running deer, the wings of a butterfly. This place is too much for me.
It isn't the place, said the gate thief. It's you. Passing through the great gate was what woke you. The air has been calling to you all along, as much in Middlegard as here in the shadow of the Mithercame.
I don't know those words, sir.
Middlegard is the word for Earth, as you know quite well, and this is the Mithercame, said the gate thief.
These mountains are the spine of the world called Westal among the mages of Middlegard, though Westal is only one of the languages here, and also the ancient half-forgotten name of a kingdom that once included all the Heddarwald and the forests of the north.
I'm a stranger here, said Sed. If the wind hadn't called me with such strength, I wouldn't have missed the passage back to Earth. Can you send me home?
You know I can't, said the gate thief. You know that Danny North took my gates from me. All but a handful. Too few for me to make a great gate, even if I wanted to.
And I don't want to. Bad enough to have you here. Worse for Middlegard if I returned you there.
Sed understood. So here I am, alone and friendless.
The gate thief looked at him quizzically.
Friendless? When they let you sleep in the place of honor near the fire?
They're kind folk and forgiving, but they don't know who I am. They only know the power of the wind, and they're afraid of me.
If they treat you well and don't seek to kill you or control you, then they're your friends.
Don't set so high a standard for friendship, Sed, or you'll have no friends.
So what are you? Asked Sed. You took me here without my consent. I hear the winds that whine around this crag far below me. If I stepped to the edge, I'd fall and die. So I'm a prisoner.
Do you think the winds you're hearing would let you fall?
They'd bear you up if you asked them to and land you gently anywhere.
Sed felt a thrill of joy at what he said.
You mean that I can fly? I mean that the wind you serve so well and rule so weakly has no desire to let you die.
I suppose, if you wanted me dead, you could have plunged me into the middle of the sea.
There's air in the sea, and it would find you instantly, gather around you, make a bubble for you, and bear you up to the surface, where the wind would dry you instantly, and again, you would fly.
Then, into the heart of a mountain. You could kill me if you wanted to.
You've figured out my secret, said the gate thief. I would like to be your friend.
What form would such a friendship take? Asked Sed. I had a friend once who provided me a home and food, and let me make my own mistakes, and figure things out for myself.
I'm the kind of friend who would like to prevent your mistakes from killing people, either directly in the storms you raise, or afterward, when their ruined crops lead to famine and death this winter.
Sed reached out and took the man's hand and gripped it.
That's what I want, too, with all my heart.
You seem to mean it, said the gate thief.
He looked relieved.
I do, said answered. I'm not a violent man. I don't like breaking things, but when the wind starts...
It takes on a will of its own, said the gate thief. It grows and grows, stronger and tighter, whirling and dancing. Do I have it right?
Yes, cried Zed.
And the ecstasy you feel, it's overpowering. You want to scream with joy. Do I have that right as well?
Zed nodded, ashamed now, because the gate thief had caught out the secret Zed had been keeping even from himself.
It's a drug. It's heroin and coke and ecstasy and methamphetamine all at once. It's way more powerful than pot, which is the only drug I ever actually tried. Once it starts, I don't even want it to stop. Even though I know the terrible things that are happening, I can feel the tearing and breaking at the edges of the wind, but I can't stop.
Meaning that you choose not to stop, said the gate thief.
That, too, was true. And Zed felt the shame and guilt burst within him. And in front of this powerful stranger, he broke down and cried.
You should have killed me in my sleep, he said. I have so much blood on my hands. Not soldiers' blood from a war, the blood of children who died in the collapse of roofs or were swept away from their parents in the wind and dashed into trees or rocks or plunged into ravines. The blood of the parents who died reaching for them or later searching for their little bodies. I should be dead. I owe 100 deaths already.
20 deaths, in fact, said the gate thief. Your shame makes you exaggerate.
20, Zed repeated, and he wept again. The gate thief's hand was on his shoulder.
I take it that you tried to stop.
The voices of the wind won't leave me alone. How do I make them still so I can think?
You don't, said the gate thief.
You sing with them. So the voice becomes your own, their movements a part of your own breath.
What you feel, when you feel all the winds of the world, is your own out-self spread as thin as air. And because you're the only wind mage who has passed through a great gate in this age of the world, you meet no other there to challenge you. The winds are yours. If you love them, said, the winds are you.
How does a gate mage know so much about how wind magery works?
Because all the magics of the world are one, said Wad. And because I loved a wind mage once.
Your wife? I had a wife. Sed thought of poor, broken Lana, and how grief and relief warred within him when she left.
My mother, said Wad.
He had a mother. He was once a child. He's a human being, like me. And also a monster, like me.
What are you going to do with me? Asked Zed. I want you to learn how to use your power to protect this world, said the gate thief.
Protect it from what?
From the monsters. From the gods.
Gods?
You called them the families there on Earth? They'll be here soon, and they'll be every bit as strong as you, and every bit as unprepared to control it. But unlike you, they'll have no consciences. They won't care what their magery costs the common people of this place.
My caring doesn't bring them back to life, said Zed.
But if you learn to master your power, you'll be far stronger than they are. At least for the first while, and perhaps you can protect the people, prevent a little of the horror that would otherwise come. Would you like to do that?
I can't even prevent my own damage.
You prevent it every day, every hour that you aren't raising a wind. You prevent it when you go among them, not to threaten them with storms if they don't obey you, but to help undo the damage that you've done.
Why do you think they love you?
because you don't think that you're a god. Or maybe because you think that godlings should be kind.
They love me?
This is a world long ruled by gods. When I closed the great gates, I weakened them. And as the old mages died, the new ones had only a fraction of their power, and life got better here. Now what counts as a great mage is a person of relatively petty power. But the mages of Middlegard will come here with power unseen in this place for 14 centuries. They'll bring their wars and rivalries with them, and then provoke more as the mages here attempt to resist them and fail. Only you can stand before them as an equal. As their master, if you prepare, if you're readier for war than they are. Sed remembered an old line from a movie. I'm a lover, not a warrior. He thought it might have been Rodney Dangerfield who said it, the man who got no respect. If you love something, then there's something to fight for, said the gate thief. I think you've come to love these people. Sed wasn't so sure. Guilt was surely not identical with love, but maybe there was a little overlap. But this is a different kind of war, the gate thief went on. The lover has to stay alive inside the warrior. Because I don't want you to destroy them, Sed. I want to master them, but then to win them over to our side.
Our side? Asked Sed. When had they become allies?
Aloud, he said, if the mages from the great families join us, who would we be fighting against then?
Someone worse, said the gate thief.
The families are monsters, said Sed. They train their children to be monsters, and I can't imagine anybody worse.
I can, said the gate thief.
Who?
Mithercaim and Middlegard are not the only worlds with people on them, and not the only mages capable of becoming monsters.
Sed felt tired. I don't want any part of it.
I know, said the gate thief. What you wanted was to pass through a great gate and find out what it would do to your power.
And it made me a monster.
It made you a great mage, said the gate thief. Your inexperience and lack of self-control led to the monstrous things you did. You can learn to control them. You can help the families learn to control their greater powers. Only then will we have a chance against the Eater of Souls.
Sed thought of how Danny and Hermia had spoken of the gate thief, the legendary enemy, the Minotaur, the terrible monster that they would have to face.
Why are you laughing? Asked the gate thief.
You said Eater of Souls exactly the way people say gate thief.
The gate thief nodded.
I was the thing that Danny North feared most.
You destroyed every gate mage you found for 1,000 years.
No, I didn't, said the gate thief. I never touched a gate mage until he tried to make a great gate. All they had to do to stay safe from me was to confine their gate making to their own world.
Why wasn't that enough?
Why couldn't they be content to gate from place to place, to heal anyone who passed through their gates? Why wasn't such a wonderful power enough for them?
Sed thought of his own experience with power.
Because if it's there, you have to reach for it.
Monkeys in the trees, said the gate thief. Always hungry for the fruit that's out of reach.
What's your name? Asked Sed.
I think of you as the gate thief, but that's only your job title.
They call me Wad, in the place I lived most recently.
And what did your mother call you? Asked Sed.
She called me Loki, but that was a job title too. It's the name given to the most powerful gate mage of the North family. It was under the name of Wad that I last tasted hope. It's the name that my friends call me.
Tell me about this monster worse than the mages of the families, said Sed.
Tell me about the Eater of Souls, so I can decide whether I'm qualified to call you Wad. I don't know if it's one being or one of many. It could be the same one coming back again and again, because if I understand correctly what it is, then it never dies and is very hard to kill. But what is it?
A man-mage, said Wad. But not the kind we're warned against. Not like the man-mages of Dapnudap, who once ruled the world of Mithercame by seducing and flattering and eventually riding men and women as their heartbeasts.
They sound bad enough.
You can still find their bodies when a man-mage's outself is riding a heartbeast. You can kill them. But from what I learned before I closed the gates, the god Bell doesn't do this. He takes over the man's body, and it isn't his out-self that comes to control it. It's his in-self.
Sed tried to understand it. So he has nothing left in his own body?
I don't know if the Bell Mages ever had bodies. I don't know what life is like in the world they come from. Or maybe I once knew, but in all my years in hiding, the memory slipped away out of reach. What I know is they passed through gates from another place into Middlegard, never in large numbers. And as I said, it's possible that it only happened once, and there's only one. Because when the body he's riding dies, it doesn't kill his in-self. He simply jumps into someone else, displacing their in-self, becoming that person.
Sed understood now what the threat was. If he takes over the body of a great mage,
then he has all that mage's power. That's what the Bell Mages did before we understood and began to fight them. A great mage of our kind would suddenly change, become more powerful and yet more ruthless. Systematically evil, that's how it looked. But when we fought against a mage who had become so terrible, we simply won. Killed him sometimes. But sometimes we were able to imprison him, talk to him. And he wouldn't remember much. It was like a dream, his body doing things that he didn't will it to do. Maybe this is how heartbeasts experience jaunts with their mage inside. The captive never felt controlled. He was simply uninvolved, cut off from the actions of his own body, half asleep in some deep sense. One of them said that he was wandering, but he couldn't say where or why things happened.
So the mage you had imprisoned, he really hadn't done the terrible things that made you go to war with him.
There was a thing that took over his body, but when we got control of him, made him powerless, the thing was no longer interested in staying inside him. It left.
How do you even fight something like that? Asked Sed.
I never tried, said Wad. All I could think of was to take the great gates from the world so that no matter what body he took, it would be a weaker one, and he could never get from there to here.
So if I went back, everyone that Danny North brought here to Mithrwee, to this world, to Westall, is now more powerful than any other mage in Middlegard. The Bell Mage will know. It will crave that power. They're all in terrible danger, and none so much as Danny North himself.
Because if the Bell Mage takes him, he can make all the great gates he wants. And if there are many of them, and not just one, they'll all be able to come here, to the heart of Magery, and make their bid to rule the universe.
Sed nodded, displacing all the gods, becoming the permanent, immortal, unkillable gods.
If they really are unkillable, if we don't stop them.
What if this Bell Mage really did take over Danny North? What could we do?
Kill Danny, said the gate thief. What choice would we have?
Why didn't you kill him already?
You were there with him at the great gate.
Because Danny North hasn't done anything that makes him deserve to die.
He made a great gate. When people made great gates, I took the power to do it away from them, said Wad. But I didn't kill them. I'm not the Bell Mage. I refuse to be a monster.
I refuse to be a monster, too. But it doesn't mean that I'm not one.
Wad smiled. I know. but I can help you get control of your power. To become master of the wind instead of the wind ruling you as it's doing now. It feels as though I'm controlling it, and yet I can't stop because I want whatever it wants.
That's right, said Wad.
You're like the wick of a candle. The flame could not survive without the wick to concentrate it, but the wick is not the master of the flame. The flame consumes it, bit by bit.
Sed knew at once that this was true. He nodded.
I wouldn't have said it that way, but it's the truth.
I'm glad that you're aware of it. It's the beginning of wisdom. It's the hardest thing for a mage to learn.
And you'll teach me, Wad, how to control my power?
Me? Wad laughed. How, when I never learned the lesson all that well myself? I'm the tool of space-time in just the way that you're the tool of the wind. No. I'll take you to the best teachers, the ones who can help mages of every kind because they have almost infinite patience and understanding, or they could never become masters of their own magery.
Who?
Tree mages. Not all of them, just a few. The best of them, the master teachers. The ones who understand that the tree is in the root. It was a tree mage of 14 centuries ago who saved me alive to do the work I'm doing now. He persuaded a great tree to open itself to me. Inside its living wood, I made a tiny gate that drew me upward through the tree, a tiny fraction of an inch every day, so little movement that I almost wasn't moving at all. But I passed through the gate each day, healing all the ills of my body. And it also healed the tree so that limbs never broke off without regrowing. The tree lived those 14 centuries in perfect health, as I did. Until I felt a shuddering in the all. I felt Danny North coming into the universe, coming into his power. I didn't understand it at the time. I only knew it was time to come out of the tree. I hardly knew who I was. I couldn't speak. I had to learn to be human again instead of being a part of the tree. But I learned. All too well. I'm human now. And Danny North is in the world. He bested me and has my gates. I'm nearly helpless to fight the Bellmage, or even the families of Middlegard. That's why I need you to become master of yourself, so you can stand beside me.
I'm not a brave man, said Zed. I don't know what I'll be like in war.
No one ever does, said Wad. And the answer is never the same on two different days.
Will you come with me to the tree mages of Goss in the forest deep and see if one of them will take you on?
I think you've already asked one, and he said yes, or you wouldn't have come to me,
Sed answered.
I've asked, said Wad, but he won't say yes until he meets you, and you have to come of your own free will.
I'll go with you and learn what I can learn, and if I find that everything you said is true, I'll stand with you as best I can.
If it isn't true, said Wad, it won't be because I lied. It will be because I'm only guessing at half the things I know about the Bellmage. And I might be wrong. I hope I'm wrong.
I hope we can defeat him in the end.
Chapter 9. Visitors. Danny wrote out the message and rehearsed it with his friends until they had it memorized. He didn't want them to read it. He wanted them to look at the families face to face, eye to eye. Not challengingly, but calmly, easily. They were the messengers of a great mage. They had to act like it. I come from Loki, the message began. He has made a great gate. He has faced the gate thief and defeated him. He has passed through the great gate to Westel and returned. He will allow each family to send two mages to Westel and return at once, but only if you agree, individually and as families, to these three promises. 1. You will not make war on or cause harm to any other family or any individual mage. 2. You will not take the lives of Drouthers or enslave them, but will respect their laws and customs. 3. You will cease the killing of gate mages or suspected gate mages. Instead, you will send them to Loki to be trained. Gate mages will never belong to any family, but only to the company of gatekeepers. I will return tomorrow for your answer. Danny sent them one at a time and watched carefully through a peephole in case someone tried to harm them. He made peepholes for Vivi and Hermia as well. The messengers held on to their amulets. Danny was determined that no one would be harmed. Hal and Xena stumbled over the memorization a little, but corrected themselves and went on. No one else made a mistake. They appeared in each family's meeting room, in front of whoever happened to be present, in response to the anonymized email they had all received. Then Danny brought each of his friends back the moment the last word was spoken. It wasn't a press conference. It was an offer and an ultimatum, both at once. He didn't have to explain that failing to agree to the terms would put any family outside the peace that Danny was establishing. That meant that when the other families sent their two mages through to Westall and back, they would be free to use their vastly increased power to make war on the non-compliant families.
"They'll all agree," Stone had said. "The question is whether they'll keep their word."
"That's why they won't know where I am," said Danny. "So they'll never know where their punishment is coming from." He spoke boldly of punishment, but he had no idea what he would actually do if someone broke their word. It depended, he supposed, on what form their oath-breaking took. If they tried to get someone to the Great Gate without permission, he would put them somewhere inconvenient. If they mistreated Druthers or started a war, he would let the peaceful families send more and more mages through to Westall until the oathbreakers were outnumbered and defeated. If they killed somebody, he would put them in Hammernip Hill. He didn't want to think about killing people with his power. But if they harmed one of his friends, he'd do what it took to make sure they never did such a thing again. His messengers were under his protection, and that had to mean something if it was going to work. But he knew they would measure his intentions by what they themselves would do with the kind of power he had. They would be ruthless, even cruel. So they would assume that he meant to do the same and would fear him. "Which means," thought Danny, "that I really am exactly what I'm trying to prevent them from becoming. A power-hungry tyrant determined to bend everyone else to his will. But if I don't keep them under control until they can see how much better this new order works than the old ways ever did, then the experiment can never work. The world will have no peace. So I must be the tyrant over the tyrants, to keep all the Druthers, the orphans, the weaker members of the families, to keep them safe. Safe from Uncle Zog and Grandpa Gish, from whoever the other family's equivalents might be." After each messenger came back to Danny's tiny living room, Hermia and Vivi continued to watch the family that had just been visited to see what they'd say. Most of them were so naive that it didn't seem to occur to them that just because the messenger was gone, no gate mage was listening. Only Hermia's family seemed to be speaking artificially, with exaggerated sweetness and willingness to comply.
"They know we're listening," said Hermia. "They won't say anything real."
"They have to eventually," said Danny. "But there's no reason to spy on them any further. They'll agree because they have no choice, and they'll keep their word because they fear what will happen if they don't."
"But Danny, my darling," said Vivi, "you haven't sent a messenger to your own dear family."
Danny didn't bother saying something petulant like, "They're not my family." Like it or not, they most definitely were his kin, the family he knew better than any other. Xena raised her hand.
"I'll go," she said. "I want to meet your real parents."
"No, you don't," said Danny.
"You think I'll embarrass you?" asked Xena.
She apparently had the idea that she was some kind of girlfriend of his, and that he simply didn't want to bring her home to meet the parents.
"I have to talk to them myself," said Danny.
"But you don't have an amulet," said Sin.
"He doesn't need one," said Hermia. "He can make a gate to any place on Earth faster than he could possibly reach an amulet."
"I knew that," said Sin.
"I just want my Danny to be safe," said Xena possessively.
She's embarrassing herself, thought Danny. Doesn't Xena see how obvious she's being?
Then it occurred to him that high school girls, as a tribe, weren't exactly subtle about who they liked and who they didn't. Nobody was going to act like Jane in Pride and Prejudice, so nobody can tell whether they liked the boy or not. Xena had decided to be in love with the guy who could take her anywhere in an instant, and so she didn't care who knew it. In fact, being obvious about it might be her way of staking a claim so none of the other girls thought of trying for him.
"You really don't know what mages are like," Vivi said to Xena with exaggerated kindness. "That's because Danny is the only one you've ever met, so you don't understand. If you make an obvious offer to any other mage from one of the families, they'll jump your bones without a quibble. Then they'll walk away, leaving whatever bastard they've conceived inside you."
"I'm not offering anything," said Xena. "I just care about him."
"Tone it down, darling," said Vivi. "You're scaring the boy."
"He's not gay, you know," said Xena. "He isn't scared of me."
"Great," thought Danny. "She knows that I'm sort of interested. How can it be so obvious?"
"If he ever sleeps with somebody," said Vivi, "he'll doubtless get all conscience-stricken and marry the poor girl, and then where would you be? Stuck with a man who will come to hate you, one you can never be equal to in any way. The permanent, magically retarded wife, always dragging him down. Is that how you want to spend your life, darling?"
"I get it now," said Pat. "When you say darling, you mean idiot. I'm glad somebody speaks catty bitchies around here," said Vivi. "I'd hate to be the only one."
"I don't speak it," said Pat, "but I understand it. I learned it in school."
"Oh, don't be modest," said Vivi. "You speak it like a native."
"Neither of you knows my mother," said Hermia. "She could take you both to school."
"So you're one-upping each other about who's the bitchiest?" asked Hal.
"It's not a competition," said Lorette.
"You just think you automatically win because you've got the biggest knockers," said Xena.
"Does anybody really say knockers?" asked Lorette.
"You have to talk to your family, Danny," said Hermia.
"I know."
"Tonight. Now. They're going to hear about the terms you offered everybody else, and if you haven't talked to them, they'll think they're not getting a chance at a great gate. Then they really will be determined to kill you."
"Oh, they've only been kidding around up to now?" asked Danny.
"Up to now, half of them have been protecting you," said Hermia.
"Or at least your own parents have been. But if you make it seem that they're shut out..."
"I know," said Danny.
"I know, I know, I know."
"So do it," said Hermia.
"Later.
Now."
Danny grinned.
"You're not the boss of me."
"I am," said Vivi. "The school has me down as your legal guardian. Go talk to your family."
"I didn't make an appointment the way I did with the others," said Danny.
"And you can be sure they know about it by now," said Hermia.
"They're already thinking the worst." She was right. Everybody was right. Danny gated to the library in the old house in the compound. The walls had been rebuilt since they tore them out looking for Danny on the day Hermia had pointed out that there was a spy inside the wall. There were new carpets. Everything was all nice and clean for company. All the aunts and uncles were sitting around the table. Baba and Mama at one end of the table. Gish and Zog weren't there at all. Danny looked at each of them in turn. Aunt Lummy and Uncle Mook, the two he knew best and trusted most. They looked worried and stern. Auntie Uck and Auntie Twang and Uncle Poot and Uncle Thor seemed much more relaxed. But Danny imagined that was because they didn't actually care what happened to Danny, or they had such rage toward him that they felt the greater need to disguise their feelings. Baba and Mama were smiling. And, oh yes, there were Danny's half-brother Pippo and half-sister Leonora. They weren't important in the council, so they must have been brought in to create some kind of cozy family atmosphere, as if they had ever given Danny the time of day. "If Zog and Gish don't sign off on this, it won't happen," said Danny.
"Hello to you too, son," said Baba.
"I'm not here as your son, sir," said Danny. "I'm not here as a North. I'm here as the only person in Middleguard who can make gates."
"Is that still true?" asked Mama.
"Your key friend and lock friend haven't picked up any new skills?"
"I'll be back when Gish and Zog are here," said Danny.
"Wait," said Baba. "We didn't think you'd want to see them, but they're just outside. You don't have to go."
Of course he wants to see them, said Auntie Twang. He wants to rub their noses in it.
In what exactly do you think I want to rub their noses? Asked Danny.
In the fact that you're a mage, said Auntie Twang. And we all know that the reason you didn't send one of your little drowther friends as a messenger was so you could come here personally and gloat.
Do you know that? Asked Danny. Of course it was true, at least a little bit. But it wasn't the whole reason, and it galled him that anybody in this room thought they knew Danny. I can't imagine why any of you thinks you know me at all. With the possible exception of Uncle Mook and Aunt Lummy, none of you ever cared enough to find out what kind of person I was when I lived here.
Yes, this is just the tone we expected from you, said Uncle Poot, self-centered and arrogant as always.
We know what power does to a person, said Thor.
And how would you know that? Asked Danny. None of you knows what power is. There hasn't been any real power in any of the families for 14 centuries, and as far as I'm concerned, it can stay that way. He thought of disappearing right then, leaving them to stew on it for a while. But that would be childish, and Vivi would tease him and Hermia would yell at him, and so he stayed where he was.
You can't hear the arrogance in your own tone, said Auntie Twang.
He's always been like that, said Zog as he entered the room. Vain about his schoolwork, vain about everything, even when he had nothing to be vain about.
Shut up, Zog, said Baba.
Oh, you think you're still head of the family, is that it, Alf? Said Zog.
He stressed Baba's original name instead of calling him Odin.
Of course he is, said Mama.
No, said Zog. He is now.
He thumbed toward Danny. The only way I could be head of this family, said Danny quietly, is if I were a member of it. But I'm not. I never was. Mama began hotly, Our blood runs in your...
The best of your blood is buried in the dirt of Hammernip Hill, said Danny. Whatever genes I have can't be helped. But as you made very clear, blood means nothing if I don't have some tangible value to you. And right now, the only way to keep the whole world from erupting in war is for all the families to know I don't belong to any of them. Nor am I one of the orphans.
Those Drekka, said Grandpa Giesh. Bastards and foundlings.
Danny wanted to make a tiny gate to make him trip and fall on the floor, but he restrained himself.
Making bastards has always been a favorite sport of the Westillians, said Danny. But the genes tell true. And the orphan mages are as powerful as you.
Are you sending orphans through the great gate, right along with the families? Asked Thor, sounding alarmed.
Oh, come on now. Don't you understand how this works? I sent whoever I want through the great gate. I've already sent 4 orphans through a great gate.
It already exists, said Zog eagerly. The new gate?
Not for you, it doesn't, said Danny.
So you aren't going to let me through, is that it? Demanded Zog. Even if the family chooses me?
With only 2 places to fill, said Danny coldly, there is no chance that they'd send a claw brother like you. They'll send Mama and Baba for exactly the reasons you made Baba the Odin and let him marry Mama, because they're the most powerful mages in the family. All the families will send their most powerful mages.
It took all Danny's self-restraint to keep from reminding Zog just how far down that list he was. From the hatred on Zog's face, Danny knew he didn't have to.
The little boy is still pissed off because you bruised his shoulder, said Grandpa Giesh.
That injury healed the moment I went through the gate, said Danny. Just because you base all your choices on spite and vengefulness and fear, Grandpa Giesh, doesn't mean that I do. You never had the power to cause me any pain that lasts.
Then Danny pointedly looked at Baba. But you did, said Danny. And he looked at Mama, too. So I want you to know that I'm past all that. I'm giving the North family equal access to the Great Gate when I make it. No more than any other family, but no less either. If it's the 2 of you who are chosen to represent the Norths in the passage to Westil, that's fine. But if not, so be it. I don't really care.
Of course it will be them, said Auntie Uck. It's already decided as soon as we learned of the terms you were giving the other families.
Danny looked at Thor, who was head of the North's network of spies.
No, I didn't find out, said Thor. Do you think the other families would let my drowther informants get close enough to know anything?
They all contacted us at once to find out whether we'd gotten an invitation from you and to see if you were treating us equally.
What did you tell them? Asked Danny.
We told them nothing, said Zog savagely.
Telling them nothing, said Danny, was the same as telling them everything. That I hadn't spoken to you yet, that you didn't know yet what would happen.
We knew, said Uncle Mook. Zog and Geesh guessed wrong about the motive, but we all knew you'd come here. Because however much you may hate and resent us, you don't want us dead.
Don't count on that, said Geesh. Spiteful little bastard.
If he wanted us dead, Aunt Lummy pointed out gently, we'd be having this meeting inside Hammernip Hill. He could have put us there whenever he wanted.
Do you accept the terms, said Danny, assuming you've heard the three promises I'm demanding from everybody?
We've heard them, said Uncle Mook. For some of us, the terms will be easy to swear to.
Which is why Zog and Geesh had to be here, said Danny. They not only have to say the words, I have to believe them.
Or what? Asked Zog. You're not sending me through the Great Gate anyway, so what can you do to hurt me?
Now it was time for a demonstration of power. Danny made a gate that swallowed Zog and dropped him from the ceiling. He landed sprawling on the table, the breath knocked out of him. The sheer surprise of it shocked everyone, and most of them jumped up or pushed back. Thor tried to do both, and ended up knocking down his chair and then falling over it.
What can I do to hurt you if you break your oath? Asked Danny quietly. Why, anything I want.
Danny rose to his feet. The others sat down except for Twang and Uck, who were helping Zog get off the table and back to his chair.
As with all the others, I'll expect your answer tomorrow.
At what time? Asked Thor.
At the time I return, said Danny.
And when will that be? Demanded Geesh,
who was apparently unhumbled by what Danny had just done to Zog. Danny didn't bother to answer. He just gated back to his living room, where the others were waiting.
That went well, said Hermia dryly.
It took a moment for Danny to realize that Hermia had been watching, and Danny had not made gates for her and Vivi this time.
Oh, don't get all uffish about it, said Hermia. I've been working on trying to do something besides lock your gates.
You made a gate? Asked Danny eagerly.
I wish, said Hermia. But I moved the other end of the last viewport you made for me.
You moved it all the way to the library?
No, said Hermia. I attached it to you, and you carried it with you. I was essentially looking and listening through the top button of your shirt.
Sin giggled. Xena glared at her.
Whoa, cool, said Wheeler.
This was a huge breakthrough. Hermia could move the end of a gate and attach it to an object.
Can you do it too? Danny asked Vivi.
I haven't tried, said Vivi. This is the first I've heard of it. I didn't even realize she was listening while you were gone, or I would have been angry at you for not making me a viewport. I may not be as young and pretty as Hermia, but I love you more than she does.
Will you teach her how to do it? Danny asked Hermia.
Of course, said Hermia. I only succeeded for the first time just now, and I only had to move it a few feet. I have no idea how far I can reach with it. Probably not very far.
So the messages are delivered, said Pat. And Hermia thinks you handled it well with your family.
Actually, I think she was being sarcastic, said Danny.
No, I wasn't, said Hermia. I really think it went well. You made your point with that bully Zog, and everybody else you treated respectfully. I don't know if I could have done that.
He's so nice, said Wheeler.
He is, insisted Xena.
Please get off my side, Xena, said Danny silently. Especially because I don't even have a side.
My point is, said Pat, the messages are delivered. So isn't it time you took us through a great gate?
You? Asked Hermia in genuine surprise. What's the point?
To see what it does to us, said Pat.
There's a lot of bastard mage blood in the world by now. Who knows whether we might not have some latent abilities?
Vivi laughed.
You don't have to invoke all those happy impregnators among the core of minor gods. Magery is certainly latent among the entire human race. Also, Danny thinks,
since he's so sure that humans began here in Middlegard and only became mages when a tribe stumbled on a naturally occurring gate and got carried to Westall.
If there were such a thing as naturally occurring gates, said Hermia, don't you think there have been one during the centuries since Loki ate all the gates? The gate thief got any gate?